had suddenly run out in front of my car, a few hundred yards away from our home. The wheels of my car ran straight over it. I had never killed any animal in this way before, and have yet to do so since. I got out of the car and went to look at the poor creature. It lay in the gutter, obviously dead, its mouth and eyes open, bared at the moon above in the clear winter sky. I remembered how the name tag around William's little wrist had a cat's face on it, since he was in a children's hospital and they liked to do things that way. I'm not a superstitious man, but I found this very frightening. William underwent surgery on a Wednesday morning. Hilary and I spent many hours pacing around central London while the operation went on. It was a useful lesson for me, when I became a fully trained surgeon myself, to know how much my patients' families suffer when I am operating. The operation was a success, and William survived, since the tumour proved to be a benign choroid plexus papilloma, even though the pathology report had reported it to be malignant. I came to realise later that few brain tumours at that age are benign, and that even with the benign tumours, the risks of surgery in such young children are immense. Years afterwards, when training as a paediatric brain surgeon myself, I watched a child bleed to death in the very same operating theatre where my son had been treated, as my boss, the very surgeon who had saved my son's life, now failed with a similar tumour. Anxious and angry relatives are a burden all doctors must bear, but having been one myself was an important part of my medical education. Doctors, I tell my trainees with a laugh, can't suffer enough. Chapter 9. Leucotomy. Noun. The surgical cutting of tracts of white nerve fibres in the brain. Original specification, prefrontal lobotomy. An instance of this. My department is unusually fortunate in having a sitting room for the surgeons beside the operating theatres. The room is furnished with the two large red leather sofas that I bought shortly after we moved from the old hospital. When our department was moved from the old hospital to a newly built block at the main hospital some miles away, the entire second floor of the new building was dedicated to neurosurgery. As time passed, however, the management started to reduce our facilities, and one of the neurosurgical theatres became a theatre for bariatric surgery, surgery for morbidly obese people. The corridors and rooms were starting to fill with unfamiliar faces and patients the size of small whales being wheeled past on trolleys. The department no longer felt like our home, and I feared that I was starting to develop the slightly alienated, institutionalised outlook that afflicts so many of the staff working in huge modern hospitals. I was sitting in the red leather sofa room one day, reading a book, while my register started a case. We had taken to keeping the door of the room locked, as there were so many strangers now present in the theatre department. As I sat on my sofa, somebody started knocking and shaking the door. I felt increasingly foolish, sitting there refusing to open the door. Eventually, to my dismay, the door was forced open, and four doctors, none of whom I recognised, burst into the room with sandwiches in their hands. Embarrassed, I stood up. "This is the neurosurgical office," I said, feeling like a pompous fool. "You're not welcome here." They looked at me in surprise. "The management said all the facilities would be shared," one of them said, looking at me in disgust. "Well, the management never discussed it with us," I replied. "If you had your own office, wouldn't you resent it if other people barged in without asking?" "We're surgeons," one of them said, shrugging. But they left the room, and I also left, too upset to remain, yet determined to maintain what little remained of our neurosurgical territory. I joined my registrar in the operating theatre where I took over the operation. It was an unusually difficult case, and I damaged the nerve for the left side of the patient's face as I removed the tumour. Perhaps this was going to happen anyway. It is called a recognized complication of that particular operation. But I know that I was not in the right state of mind to carry out such dangerous and delicate surgery. And when I saw the patient on the ward round in the days afterwards, and saw his paralyzed face, paralyzed and disfigured, I felt a deep sense of shame. It is little consolation that my colleagues and I have been left undisturbed in the red leather sofa room, our little oasis, ever since, although I believe I have become an object of deep dislike among many of the other surgeons in the hospital. For reasons that have never been determined, all the windows in the offices for the operating theatre block, including the room with the red leather sofas, are 5 feet off the floor. All you can see through them, once you sit down, is the sky, with an occasional plane nosing its way through the clouds towards Heathrow, or more often a pigeon, or sometimes a seagull, and very occasionally a kestrel. I have spent many hours lying on the longer of the two sofas, reading medical journals, struggling to keep awake, waiting for the next case to begin, watching the dull clouds through the high windows. In recent years, the delays between finishing one operation and starting the next have become longer and longer. The trouble is that we cannot start the operation until we know that there is going to be a bed into which to put the patient after the operation, and this is often not the case. The stream of initiatives and plans and admonitions from the government and management that we must work ever more efficiently feels like a game of musical chairs. The music is constantly being changed. Indeed, with the latest round of reforms, the government has even changed the orchestra. But there are always more patients than beds, and so I spend many hours lying on a sofa, staring gloomily at the clouds, watching the pigeons hurrying by. I was lying on the sofa, waiting for the next case to start and dozing over a book. My colleague, who operates on the same days as I do, was sitting in a chair, waiting, like myself, for his next case to be anaesthetized.
"I see that we have been told that the whole culture of the NHS must change, after all those patients died in Stafford. What a whitewash! It's all about who's in charge," he said.
I remembered, when still a student, I had spent several months working as a nursing assistant on the long-term psychogeriatric ward of one of the huge long-term psychiatric hospitals that used to surround London. Most of the patients were profoundly demented. Some had come from the outside world with degenerative brain diseases. Some were schizophrenics who had already spent most of their lives in the hospital and were now sinking to the end of their lives. To go to work at 7 in the morning, to be faced by a room of 26 doubly incontinent old men in beds, is an education of sorts, as it was to wash them and shave them and feed them and pot them and strap them into geriatric chairs. I met some nurses who were utterly unsuited to the work, and others who were quite remarkably patient and kind. In particular, a wonderful West Indian man called Vince Hurley, who was the charge nurse for the ward. It was miserable work, with little reward, and I learned much about the limitations of human kindness, and in particular my own. I was told that in the 19th century, when the severe and prison-like hospital had been built, that there had been a hospital farm on the extensive grounds, and that the patients had worked on the farm. But when I was there, the grounds were just a series of wide, empty fields. Rather than carry out farm work outside, some of the patients now received something called occupational therapy. This involved 3 occupational therapists, stout middle-aged ladies in maroon-coloured housecoats leading out a straggling line of demented old men onto the fields around the hospital twice a week. It was 1976, the year of the Great Drought, and the hospital grounds had been burnt brown and yellow, and the patients' faces had been burnt red, since most of them were on the antipsychotic drug Largactil, which is a photosensitizer. The patients were given a football and left to their own devices. Most of them sat down and stared into space. The three therapists also sat down. One